Hello and welcome to the Now Spinning Magazine podcast with me, Phil Aston. And on this episode, I'm delighted to welcome back Del Brumman from the band Stray. The last time Del was on the show, we talked a lot about his background, the story of Stray, and when we came right up to the present day. And where we left off was that there was going to be a new album by Stray, and that time has arrived. And in fact, many of you will know that I've reviewed this album already, and I'm a bit of a fan. I absolutely love it. So I'm absolutely thrilled to have Del back with me today to talk about specifically this superb new album called About Time. Welcome, Del.
Oh, thank you very much, Phil. I really do appreciate that. I'm sort of when I watched your YouTube review, I have to say, a tear came to my eye because you probably know as a journalist that when you write something and it touches somebody, it's a bit special. You kind of always hope that that will happen. And you don't often hear what people say because they play their albums in their own home and you might speak to somebody at a gig or something. But no, I very much appreciate it, Phil. Thank you very much.
No, more than welcome. And because I remember the album arrived and it was on my playlist pile and I kept thinking, what should I play? I was going out in the car and I thought, it's about time I put the new Stray album on and see what it's like. Yeah. And the journey was just about the right amount of time for the whole album to have played. But as soon as the first track, I Am, started, the first thing that got me was the lyrics and the joyous intent behind them. I am a lion, I am a tiger, I am a rock and roll survivor. I mean, you might think, well, that's got all the cliches you want to hear from that kind of wordage. But from what your story from when we spoke last time and that kind of line in the sand that it felt like you're writing out saying, here I am, this is what I do. I can just imagine that this song will be in your set list for as long as you tread the boards. It is in your set list, isn't it?
yes, we have introduced it recently, yes, along with several others from the album. And you probably can appreciate the additional problem I have, or the band has, going so long, because if you put something in, what do you leave out? But I don't know, it's all part of life's rich tapestry, I suppose. But
it is, and I understand that as a kind of a complication for a band that's got the legacy and history of a band that Stray has. And I think a lot of fans, some fans, we can become so fixated on the past that we forget that these musicians that we've grown up with are still creating really good art and really good songs. And it, you know, if you have an open mind and heart, that actually sometimes you suddenly realize, a bit like Uriah Heep, they're producing some of the best music they've ever done. But they have to keep juggling around. They've got to put certain songs in the set, and the set can't keep getting longer and longer. It must be the same for you. But I mean, I made a point of saying in my review that this was as good as, and in many places better than, many of your albums through your 70s career. And I think a lot of these songs, this is an anthem, isn't it? I Am. It's an anthem. It doesn't matter whether you play guitar or not. You just feel like, yeah, I'm getting on perhaps a bit. I've got a few years behind me, but I can relate to that. I am I am a tiger and a rock and roll survivor myself.
it's funny. I take in everything you said about, particularly about the lyric, because it could be a whole line of cliches. And I was very reluctant to, I kept thinking, what else can I write instead? What else can I write instead? But it worked. And when I played it to the guys, I thought the first thing they're going to say to me is, you can't sing something like that, you know? I sort of stuck with it. And the more I kind of played it back and the more I tried to change the lyric, I thought, no, this is what I'm trying to say. As corny as it might be, it's plain English. And it's that kind of lots of musicians. It's not just for me. It's lots of us around the place. And you mentioned Uriah Heep. Well, Mick Box is another one, you know. through all the trials, you know, this is going to sound corny as well, Phil, but all the trials and tribulations you find in the rock and roll business, I believe, like I am and like Mick, I didn't mean to say that, but like I am, and as Mick Box, it also is, I'm sure, you're so passionate about your music that, you know, you keep knocking me down, but I'll keep standing up to some people's annoyance. But and it was just that process of I wanted it to be strong musically as well. And I'm thinking, what is stronger than, you know, saying I'm a lion, I'm a tiger, I'm going to really fight this. And it's almost like it's a battle between you and the music industry, you know, just to keep going. And so I settled for it in the end, and I was pleased and surprised also that the band liked it, because on two accounts. One, I said I was a little bit concerned about the lyric, but also we had discussed about doing another album, and we were, the actual plan, if you like, was we're going to do like more of a rock album, you know, that's what it's going to be. So the first song I bring them is on acoustic guitar, complete opposite to what, and I'm but it was that contradictory mind that Del Bromham has sometimes where, well, even if you don't like it, can I just play you this song? Because I had a couple of others, but before we get going, can I just play this one? And it was just literally, I'll sit down with an acoustic guitar. What do you think of this? You don't have to like it. I like it. And I can remember Carl and Simon, the, you know, drums and keys respectively, I played the song and there was like a moment's silence. They looked at each other and they looked at me and said, we've got to do that one. I said, I didn't think you'd like it. No, it's so that's it. I've said it before. It was almost a mistake. It almost didn't happen because I didn't think it would be what they wanted, but they did want it. And the reaction to that, as we're talking, the album's been out about 2 weeks now. And the reaction to the album has been excellent. I've not had any negative comments. And a lot of people, like yourself, Phil, have picked out I Am as the one that kind of leads it off, you know.
I think it leads it off because you said you wanted to do a rock album, and you start off with you introduce a song that, on the acoustic guitar. And I think this is the thing that rock music is about attitude and feeling, isn't it? And because the lyric is rock music. But the acoustic guitar gives it a kind of like a clearer entry point to anyone else who might think they're not into this kind of music. But they hear that, they hear the lyric, they hear the joyous nature of the chorus and the positive nature of it. And again, we're living in fairly dark times at the moment. And and also, again, anyone that knows a bit of your story or, you know, what it's like being a musician, it's like peaks and troughs, isn't it? Anyone's career is like all of a sudden everything's going really well, and then nobody wants you. Then you can't get arrested, and then it all comes back again, and it's like it just goes like that, doesn't it? And here you are in 2023, when many of your contemporaries have thrown the towel in many times, and you've just released a stunning album. You know, it is the fact that all the other songs back up behind this opening song in such a great way, which you'll come on to, kind of shows how how strong you still are as a rock and roll survivor.
Well, the other thing about it is, and it's just harking back to your kind of opening statement, what the opening lines we talked about, which is what do you leave out and what do you put in? I also felt personally it was important that the musicians which are on the album, which is now the new version of Stray, they deserve to be heard, you know, and the songs are the way they can play them, and they will be heard with them playing them. And, you know, it wasn't really, I didn't feel now that there's an album there, which they've all contributed on, that they should put it to one side and just continue to play the songs that were recorded 40, 50 years ago. It didn't seem right somehow. And how can you go forward if you keep looking backwards?
Exactly.
So if, you know, and, you know, blowing my own trumpet, I thought the songs stood up. Without sounding contrived, I did want to make a concerted effort when I wrote the songs for the album, that they would be hooky, that they would perhaps appeal to a wide audience. I don't know if I told you the story before when we last spoke, but I'd had some songs already written, and it was just kind of right as COVID started. And there was a program on television, because there wasn't going to be a Glastonbury that year.
Yeah.
They put a program on there, like the best of Glastonbury over so many decades.
Yeah.
And the thing that struck me was that regardless of whether it was a well-known band or a well-known band, the ones that went down the best were the ones that had the melody that came in with a lyric that they could all join in with. And yeah. Interestingly, the first song which I wrote for the album was taken from my view of seeing a Glastonbury audience, and that was Raise Your Hand. Because as soon as that band, whatever band it was, got into the stride mm-hmm. with the melody and the chorus, if the crowd had never heard the song before, they were up there, I was like, Raise Your Hand, that's a great title for a song. And that was actually the first song I took along for the band, because I thought that was where we were going. So then the game plan was, okay, boys, we're going to make the Glastonbury album. That's where the whole point of, I wanted to make every song count. I didn't want one to be a filler. Every song, not that I've ever thought that way, but I thought it was really important, and I also thought it was very important with the new lineup, purely because the new lineup, you know, being a big head, it sounds fantastic. They're great musicians to work with. They do the old songs justice, as well as the new ones, obviously, and all credit to them, and why not, you know?
Well, I'd like to draw special attention to Simon on the keys, because I think he has made a huge, influence on the band, in the sound of the band. Yeah. I think because there is definitely a kind of purple-esque, heapish feel to some of the tracks, which of course I absolutely love. I love Hammond organ, and it really it's really kind of padded out.
Me too. I'm a frustrated Hammond organ player. That's why on the old albums, you'll always see somewhere on an old album me playing a Hammond organ, a B3 or a C3. But actually finding Simon, although, you know, a few years younger, shall we say, he is kind of on the same page as me. He knows if I go to if I say to him, I'm thinking Hammond here, he'll do it. If I start thinking piano here, he'll do it. And he's got such a wide knowledge of music, particularly with the keyboard. I just knew it was right. You know, he first started playing with me when I just was augmenting the band for when I did some Blues Devil shows. You know,
I
thought this is too good to not use. And I know, obviously, he's got his own band, Pearl Handle Revolver. So when we did the last couple of tours, I said to him, do you want to come along on tour with Stray? You know, do you want to play keys? And he said, yeah, okay, because I didn't have an awful lot on with Pearl Handle Revolver. And I kind of kidnapped him. he came along for the ride, and he stayed and made the album as well, you know, as well as producing it, which was good because we did it at his studio, and he just knew what to do. You know, it was very much all on the same level, and I think that's what made it easier. We didn't, you know, nothing. It wasn't like we could all sit around and jam it and play these things. It was kind of, yeah, I know what that is, and you're quite right. He's a little secret weapon now. And I've got him gaffer taped to the Hammond organ stall so he can't get away.
Has that helped give you more freedom for playing the guitar as well, having this kind of extra layer of instrumentation? Is it giving, or did some of the songs take on a almost a different dimension when you started to hear the keyboards in amongst it? I mean, or did you?
That's a tough one to answer. When I write a song, it's a strange process for me personally.
Mm-hmm.
I can often when I write a song, as I'm writing it or as it's written, I can always hear what I think should be on it. I've always been guitar, bass, drums, and keyboard, whether it be piano, Hammond, or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's probably what I meant in my last little paragraph, as it were, is that it was so easy for me to actually say to him, you know, I want Hammond on this one, because he knew exactly what it was. I didn't have to explain anything. It was just sort of second nature to him. It was. Despite what the album might sound like, for me, it was easy finding the right parts of the jigsaw puzzle, really, you know.
Well, the next track, Living the Dream, is another one of my favourites. And for me personally, this meant a lot, because I think sometimes it kind of meant to me that sometimes you can take it for granted what's going on around you, and you don't realise actually that when you look, if you strip away all the negative things you think are bogging you down, actually things are actually not that bad. I mean, I'm lucky that I live near the coast. So your lyrics about walking along on the beach on a sunny day and realizing, gosh, I'm living the dream. It made me realize, actually, Phil, you are. I like that. And I like the other part in the lyrics when you talk about meeting somebody else and they're also looking at it and they're living the dream. This is a really observant and clever song. Great track.
Thank you very much. It's a story for me of two parts, really, because I always go and speak to people after the gig, you know, whether it be at the merch desk or whatever. And so many times people have said to me, oh, you should write a book, you know, will come out of my own. And I say, and Annie, my partner, she said to me, you should write a book. And I said, no one would be interested. And she said, well, you've got two grandchildren. They'd like to know what their granddad did. So I started writing the book. But the part two of the story is that as you're talking to me now, I'm in different surroundings. I'm in my place. I've got a place in Spain.
Oh, yeah.
Which I bought about 20 years ago. And while I was over here a couple of years ago, I was walking down to the beach and the pavement was hot on the street. And there was a group of people walking towards me, and I carried on walking, and all of a sudden I could hear like a pitter patter of feet, and you just know that someone's coming to speak to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I'm miles away from England and I'm walking down to the beach in Spain, and it's an English guy. And he said, sorry, he said, I don't want to trouble you, but are you Del Brummam? I said, yeah. He said, what are you doing here? I said, well, I've got a place up the road and, you know, I've just taken a couple of weeks off while we're on tour. And amongst the conversation, he said, you're living the dream. And what has been said, because, I mean, the other thing is, you know, when you see bands do a gig, you see them on stage for an hour or an hour and a half, and you think, oh, what an easy life. They don't realise that you might have set off at lunchtime. You're not going to get until 4 o'clock in the morning, you know.
Yeah, that's very true.
I made the second verse, rather than being a total stranger, I actually have seen people who I do know from way back, and they see me again. Oh, you're looking good. You're looking good. Must be doing well. Bet you're living the dream.
Yeah.
And it's a funny thing as well, Phil. I don't know whether I've just noticed it more, but it's a phrase I keep hearing quite a lot of, you know, just generally, whether it's in the media or, oh, yeah, you're living the dream. And also, finally, there's a chap called Peter Barton who runs Rock Artist Management. And I hope he doesn't mind me saying so, but he does remind me a little bit of Les Dawson when he's talking on the phone to me. and he nearly always ends his conversation, oh, that's it, Del, you're living the dream, you're living the dream. So that's partly to Peter Barton as well. There you go.
Well, it's a great track. And the next one, Black Sun, I love this. It's got like a really like moody riff. It's one of my favourites again. The guitar harmonies are a little bit kind of remind me a little bit of Thin Lizzy, but again, it's the Hammond organ which creates this really rich texture of sound. Love it.
Well, I'll get you into a little trade secret here. You've made a comparison of a couple of other bands. When we started playing it back, it actually reminded me of Focus.
Oh, interesting.
Well,
I like them. Yeah.
Well, the next funny bit is if you try and yodel along with it as I was doing, it'll sound like Focus. Which is interesting because when I get back from Spain next week, I'm doing a show with Focus.
Are you? Yeah.
Well, I am, yes.
Well maybe they could come and do that yodeling bit just on that track.
Well, bear in mind, I was brought up when Frank Ifield had a record. He taught me to yodel. So I know all about yodeling. I could teach Thijs van Leer a thing or two, I'm sure.
Well, that's something the world needs to see. The next one, Blood from a Stone. This is a lot of social observations in this, aren't there? The invisible threats we had during lockdown and stuff. And it's very poignant reflection of the times we're living in. Lyrically, the whole album is very on the button with what's going on around you. Is this the first time you've had an album that's like that? I'm thinking of all looking back through your back catalogue, songs were like, quite succinct, would be a love song, this, but this one seems like a lot of the songs are interconnected, like there's a theme running through it.
That wasn't the intention, but I guess perhaps, you know, there could be lots of reasons really, but maybe because of the world we were living in, me personally as a writer was seeing as many negatives as positives, if you like. The Blood from a Stone thing actually was also not unlike living a dream, thinking of a recollection. And I can remember driving, because I live out of London now, although I was born and brought up in London. I remember on one particular day going down to London, I was going right in the heart of London, where I knew there were millions of pounds. There was loads of properties bought up by wealthy investors that were empty. And there were people living on the street, some possibly ex-servicemen, some people who've just had a real more than their share of bad luck. And I just thought, you know, that Blood from a Stone was an old saying that my mum and dad used to say, you know. You know, and it's an old saying. And I thought, well, the song is just the unfairness of life, really. You have, you know, a person with nothing sitting on the doorstep of someone who's a multimillionaire. You know, it just seems very odd, you know, and unfair. And yeah, it was just something I can't say I'd be inspired to write about it, but it was just social comment, I guess.
Yeah, because there's quite a few tracks that have that. I mean, the next one, Shout, is very much like social media, isn't it? Everyone showing off about mine's bigger than yours and better than yours. And
well, you know. Dare I mention, there's something going on in the Far East at the moment where my God's bigger than your God kind of thing,
yes.
You know.
Yeah.
But interestingly enough, I do like watching. I'm a bit of a TV addict at times, but one of the things I noticed was on the program Question Time that was on, in an ideal world, politicians do themselves no favours because they're supposed to be on there having an intelligent debate. And I've watched it so many times where instead of having a debate, one shouts over the top of the other one. And that's just a kind of a generalisation of, almost the only way you're going to get through life is if you shout louder or bully the next man, you know. And that's kind of what that song was about.
But musically, it's got this kind of Eastern feel. It's a really intricate song. It's got very a great feel to it, because I know we're talking about the lyrics, but musically, this is another superb rock song.
I've always been a fan of Eastern music, and if you went right back to the very first Stray album, the opening track on side two of the vinyl was Time Machine.
Oh yeah, great track. Yeah.
And I've always been interested in that kind of the drone thing on it. In fact, you could argue that the introduction of the other song you said, "Living the Dream."
Yeah.
I've got it, the guitar E tuned down to a D, so the whole of the guitar is a drone.
So could you segue from Time Machine into one of these two tracks in the set?
I think anything's possible, Philip, especially when I have a go.
That'd be great. And then Better Day is again part of, again, the social commentary of what it was like when we were all stuck, isn't it?
This is an album where I've battled against myself of should I write these things down or not, you know, and that really was, I think I'm right in saying I was possibly picking up on a lot of what was going on at the time, because I can remember, like, when COVID first hit, you know, watching TV and there was the various experts on there saying, oh, it could take up to 10 years to find a cure for this.
Yeah.
It's never been. And you know, I think, you know, our band stopped touring. Nobody could work. Nobody could tour. Nobody could go out. And it was, you know, the like that I've certainly never seen in my lifetime. But as time went on, I detected a kind of an undercurrent of optimism. And I think that's something which is a good thing about the human spirit. You know, it tends, if we're very lucky, our human spirit really does fight against this, and optimism, you know we're going to have a better day. Today's not good. Tomorrow's going to be a better day. And I've known many people like that. I guess really with the album, I said this to somebody else recently, trying to analyse myself, I think, that if I was a medieval minstrel,
yeah,
I would have probably been wandering around the streets saying, we have a little virus here, it's coming out today. And I would be actually telling the stories of the time. So it's quite stupid. It's a kind of a parallel. I do try to write in the third person or as an observer.
Yeah.
Maybe it doesn't always come out that way, but that is my sort of intention, because I don't really want to hang a label on myself as being some kind of, you know, person who's a fighter, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're observations, really, and all the songs were about that in some way, shape, or form. You know, what was going on about that time. You know.
Yeah, that's really good. And the next track is my favourite, I think, overall. And I'll probably pronounce this wrong. It's the Sword of Damocles. Yeah. This is just an epic, moody, emotional song, and it's so versatile. There's so much. This is like classic Stray, but with extra bits bolted on. What's the story behind this one?
Well, I'd heard the phrase "Sword of Damocles," and the story of this was, and I think I'm pronouncing the name right, there was a Roman emperor called Dionysus, I think his name was, and he had his court, as many of them did. And I guess they were at that time. He was living in times where he had his wealth. He was the most powerful man in the Roman Empire, and one of his courtiers was called Damocles. And apparently, in a conversation one day, he said, "You're living the dream." No, he didn't say that. he said to him, "You know, oh, you know, you are so lucky. I wish I was you," kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said to me, "You wouldn't like to live my life. you know, it's that walk a mile in my shoes, basically.
Yeah.
He said, you wouldn't like to live my life. He said, because there's always someone out to get you. You know, and we've seen that recently in politics. There's always someone out, whether you like certain politicians or not, it would appear in the last few years there was always someone out to get you.
Yeah, very true.
And I
very
think
true.
That often happens when you're in a position of authority. There's always someone wants to take you down. And I read the story of the Sword of Damocles. I thought that's an interesting parallel that goes on today. And I don't know why it was. One of those songs, and I always think the better songs are the ones that come very quickly.
Mm.
I've no idea where it came from. I just sat down at the guitar and it just kind of came pouring out, you know, the whole arrangement. It just seemed to, it was almost like someone else is holding my hands for me here doing it, you know. The only thing I can add to that is that I'm rather hoping that the next James Bond film will be called The Sword of Damocles, because I think I've got an excellent tune for that film.
I think you have. I love it. All the vocal arrangements, the guitars, the riffs. It's just a great, great track. Now on the album, everybody buy a copy.
I've got one.
Yeah. Every home should have one, everyone.
Yes. Yeah.
It's important. It's mandatory. On the album, that technically is kind of like seen as the last track of the album, because the three tracks are seen as bonus tracks. What made you draw a line after that one?
Our intention was to do a vinyl album.
Yeah.
And
which you have, haven't you, for anyone watching? There is a vinyl version.
It's actually being pressed as we speak.
Yeah.
But the plan A was it's going to be a vinyl album. But the problem with vinyl albums is you can't really go more than about 45 minutes in total.
Yeah, 20 minutes aside, yeah.
So we had recorded some more songs, but even though I said to you earlier on that the Raise Your Hand was the one that I thought it was going to, I thought we were going to be more AC/DC than Genesis or Focus. So that was why Raise Your Hand is probably the lone song on there, which is like straightforward guitar, bass, drums, a little bit of keys.
Hmm.
Just a rock out, a simple tune.
Yeah.
As we now know, it didn't turn out that way. And as you have observed, those songs, the first ones you said about, they do tend to roll into each other.
They do.
They do have, although they're not all in the same key, or they do seem to have a connection.
Yes.
And by some strange quirk of fate, they work out just about enough time to do a vinyl.
Ah.
So it was almost decided for us, that's the one that's going to be. So the lads said to me, because I'm older than them, I remember vinyl the first time around, and I think our first album might have even been on Cylinder. It was so old. On the Cross and Blackwell label. Yeah, it's one of my old ones. But yeah. So the other guy said, well, what are we going to do with the other three tracks? So I said, well, we'll speak to some record labels. I said, but I know what record labels are like. They'll say, what else have you got? And we'll say, well, this is the album. And they say, well, you've got to make it something different. You can get a lot more on there. We'll call them the bonus tracks. Mm-hmm. So it actually went back to front, really. It made more sense that the vinyl had come out first.
True, yeah.
And then the CD. But, you know, like my mum, when she used to cook dinners, I don't like to waste anything. So we didn't waste them. And once again, you know, I wanted people to hear them, you know. All three songs actually have a kind of social comment in the lyric.
They do. I'd said in my review that although they were listed as bonus tracks, they you didn't feel as if you'd just left the room and gone into another. They all gently just move straight in. They've also got some social commentary. It just fits as a one big story.
Yeah, I mean, that is a good thing, really. It's not as if they're, you know, we've done something way off piece as well. Having said that, probably a criticism of Stray in the past, people, particularly the media, not yourself, of course, particularly the media, do like to put acts in a genre or a bucket or a category.
Yeah.
And I mean, years go by. I think journalists are a little bit more savvy these days. But in the 70s, the first inception of Stray, we found it very difficult to be accepted, that a Stray album was going to be about songs. I suppose we were a bit of an odd one, because our stage act was always rocky and lively, and then they might get a quiet song like on the first album. You know, we were rocking away like good, and all of a sudden you get something like Around the World in 80 Days, which was like a ballad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we were always criticised for being too varied, and my argument was I was brought up on the Beatles, and they used to have a different – every song was different. And I thought, well, if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for me. This album, going back to the new album about Time, I think we've kind of cracked it, in as much as there is a variance of styles on there, but somehow, and maybe it's the use of super glue, they do connect in some way.
They do.
I'm really chuffed that you found that as well when you reviewed it, and I thought, oh, this fella actually gets it.
Well, quite a few people in the Now Spinning Magazine Facebook group also bought this, and they all love it. And many of them have been fans for many years. And I think there is lots of light and shade on this album. It's not just on one level. And I think lyrically, I think lyrically it's stronger. It has more connection to the audience from what we've all been through. Yeah. For what we've all been through collectively, I think. Yeah. You can relate to it, and the music kind of connects to how we've all been feeling, and the songs are strong, and it's also very, positive and very uplifting. Although some of the lyrics are of observational about times that some of us probably might like to forget, it doesn't feel like that. It feels like we're acknowledging it, but we're moving forwards. Like you said, there's something in the human spirit that looks for optimism in the darkest of places. And I think this album is a great album for 2023.
Well, I think it's, if you like, I never thought about it until you just said that, but it's almost documenting history in a different way. You know, things that happened around that time. And interestingly enough, I actually think it's people who've come along to my gigs at different times have made me realise the importance of the written word, and I say this because we started playing one of the songs from the Valhalla album a while ago called 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue.
Yeah,
and obviously we know what the address is, the White House.
Yeah,
and I wrote that song around the time of the war in Iraq. Now, once again, I didn't write it with any political view. I wrote that one about when I had seen newsreels on there about, you know, every mother has a son or a daughter. Some of the sons go in the army. They go out and fight. Some get killed. Some don't. Ordinary civilians get killed. But they're always like a mother, father's kids. But the interesting fact about that song was when we played it for a while, I had on quite a few occasions, not just a one, not it happened to me once kind of thing.
Yeah.
On quite a few occasions, you know, I always make a point of going and standing by the merchant desk and having a chat with people and if someone wants something signed. And I had, over the gigs we did over a period of time, I had quite a few servicemen who came up to me and said, "That song, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, I just want to show." One guy, and he almost broke my fingers. He said, "I want to shake your hand." He said, "I was in Afghanistan." He said, "I lost some friends there." A good friend of mine, which I never realized because she never actually said it to me.
Yeah.
So we played it in a small club, and I happened to see her go outside. And then one of my friends went outside, and she was in tears outside. And she said, "That song, since 1600 Pennsylvania." I said, I'm really sorry. I didn't want to upset you." She said, "No, you're not upsetting me." She said, "It was emotional." She said, "My nephew was in the army and he got shot in Afghanistan." And I learned over a period of time that, you know, it's the words. They don't always have to be joyous, but they can tell a story. And I was able to tell that serviceman's story from my point of view and what he saw. When I had my last solo album, White Feather,
which is a great album.
As you know, I lost my daughter around that time. And even the album before that, there's a couple of songs in there about family from the Nine Yards album. But when I wrote the White Feather album, that particular song, White Feather, I had so many people come up to me. You know, I've actually seen people in the audience in, you know, with tears in their eyes, and they come up to me and say, really moved by that. And it happened to me. I lost my daughter. I lost my son. I did an acoustic show last weekend, and I played that song. And I must have had 5 or 6 people come up to me afterwards and say, "Thank you for that. Thank you for that song." And going back to what I was saying, it really makes it worthwhile knowing that you're writing something that is that touches people. You know, it's something that I never thought of so much many years ago.
Well, they're a bit like whereas you watch a movie and there's obviously music in the movie or the drama to emphasize the feelings and the words of what's being put across. In a song, the movie plays in your head. It's your imagination, isn't it? It's your own experiences in life that bring the lyrics together.
I get that when I'm writing songs. I always seem to have an idea in my head what it's going to be like, because it's almost like I've got the movie going on. I think, I wish I could plug my head in and film this. I can remember. I won't mention any names, but I remember some years ago when we had the original band. One of the band members on a couple of songs I wrote. What do you want to write songs like that for? You know, but I stuck to my guns.
I think that's what makes this album to me so special, is the fact that I can tell it's coming direct from you, from your heart, your imagination, but also based on how you're feeling. And that's why I think a lot of fans, well, not just fans, people will just stumble across this album, probably because some algorithm on Spotify will suggest it to them, will suddenly realize that this is good. Who's this by? And maybe one day you'll be playing some festival where people are punching the air and waving flags around.
Oh, I hope so. it's funny that the first one that was on the bonus tracks, That Is Not Enough, I couldn't help myself. I had to write that one. And it was one of those ones where I thought to myself, well, my choice of lyric on this might offend people, but sometimes you've got to offend or shock to get your point across. But the whole point about that is it's like, and this is why I might get political, and I don't want to get political, but the point about it was that I was born in 1951, right? And I can remember going to my junior school, which is in the late 50s and early 60s. And even back then, we had these doing collections for Biafra. All that sort of thing. And it's been well catalogued that a lot of those people that we see on television, you know, poor people, they don't get the money that people like you and me send them. You know, there's even Mr. Geldof had problem getting all his multi-millions to the people who needed it, you know?
Yeah, very true. Yeah.
And yeah, I won't go too far in it, but that's the general gist of it. And here I am, you know, 70 years old, and it's still, you still have the same films plays on television. True. And ironically, a couple of the countries and territories are the wealthiest in the world. You know, you've got India spending billions to send a rocket to the moon.
Very true.
While their people are starving just down the road. And the same in Africa. You've got all these wealthy states with all these people starving to death. Yet they look to other people to give the money, and you give them the money, but the dodgy people in between steal half of it.
Very, very true.
And it's like, you know, my thought was, you know, it's a, once again, instead of shouting each other, get all the people of the world together, all the world leaders, and say, right, we've got all this money. Let's do something positive with
positive
it.
Positive with it. Yeah. Very
that
true.
Was what that song was about. I just thought it was ironic. Here I am, 7. I thought probably when I was about 10 years old and sticking my shilling or sixpence in a box, that by the time I was 70, that would all be gone. It's no better than it's ever been.
No, I would have thought the same as well. So the album's out. It's only been a couple of weeks. What's the plans for 2024? Is it to tour the album?
Yes, that is the plan at the moment. Paul, our tour manager, and he also runs Monstrous Child Management. As we speak, he's speaking to various people to get some shows in. He's contacted me, even though I'm over here, making sure we've got some of the dates availability. Some festivals as well coming up. I mean, this has all been done around the wrong way, and that was on the bounce of COVID, really, because normally, you know, right, we're going to record an album. It's going to be ready by so-and-so.
Then we're going to tour it.
So in an ideal world, we should be touring it now. Hmm. But because we already had a couple of people interested in a deal for the album, but they both fell through for various reasons, partly, funnily enough, COVID financial reasons. But this has now come out on Talking Elephant Records.
Yeah.
And we will be, going back to your original question, touring again or properly next year. We did a couple of shows. We've done a couple of shows with it. We did kind of a launch party show at the 100 Club a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And it's going back to putting new songs in. That journalist chap, you know, Dave Lynn, came along.
Yeah, yeah.
And we actually did 5 songs from the album. And he said to me, that was remarkably brave, putting 5 in. He said, but all the songs are really good and they really work. So
yeah,
that gave me, and I think the band, more confidence that we could actually, for want of a better phrase, get away with it, you know.
I definitely think you can. Because I think it's a shame with some legacy bands where they try and put some new songs in. Deep Purple are a perfect example, and then the year goes by, something else comes out, and they don't play anything from the most recent repertoire, recent albums, because they feel they can't. And I think that it's important that the new musicians, the new contributors to the sound and legacy of the band, should be able to play their songs. I think they're brilliant.
This was something else that I've not mentioned to anybody outside the band circle, was that there was a time where I was wondering whether, and that's predominantly, I guess, to give, I'll give them a name check, Carl Randall, Simon Rinaldo, Colin Kempster, and my old mucker Pete Dyer, the new lineup, its own identity. And I had suggested on a couple of occasions, do you think we should use the name Stray? You know, it's a new lineup. Am I doing you disservice by using a name that's been around a long time? And the young ones in the band, No, they wanted to be part of the history.
Yeah, of course.
And they said, no, it should be a Stray album. It should be the Stray album. So it was partly to do with them, really. You know, the option was mentioned, shall we change the name? But no, so it's another Stray album. All 50 odd years on, we're still here.
Well, it's a very, very good one. It really, really is. So the best place people to buy it, is it just buy it from any online outlet, or would you prefer them to go to your website?
They can go to our website, whatever's easiest for them. They can buy it from our website. If you Google up Stray the Band, there's a couple of things on there. But, Talking Elephant Records also will have it online.
Okay, and the vinyl?
Amazon and all the usual outlets.
And the vinyl album is due soon, isn't it?
The vinyl album is due soon. At the moment, it's going to be a limited edition of, I'm just trying to think, I think there's 250 copies being printed.
Wow.
I think the first 150 are in orange vinyl, but they're all going to be autographed.
Wow, so, brilliant.
So that we're going to, we got an endorsement from Biro Bic, and we're going to be signing like mad. we thought that it would be kind of almost like a little collector's item.
Yeah, I'm sure it will be. I reckon they'll sell really quickly.
We've advertised that's going to happen, and we've had scores of people saying, I want one, where can I buy it? So
yeah,
that is going to be here. And our friend Peter Bullock, who is also the guitarist for the Debbie Bonham Band.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I know, yeah.
He's got his company Sound Discs, and he's doing it. He's going to press them out for us with his company. And every company we spoke to said, oh, we probably won't be able to get it till the new year. And Pete, bless him, we told him what our project was, and we should have them before Christmas. So it'll be a nice Christmas stocking filler if you've got stockings that wide. But we also know, funnily enough, there's been a couple of record labels sniffing around saying, well, what are you going to do with the vinyl after those first ones? So watch this space. It could be a recurring product. But I'm just very pleased after all this time. I'm still able to go out there and do it. And there's going to be a new album for people to hear, an album which I am very, very proud of, very proud of.
No, and so you should be, Dale. It's absolutely fantastic. And it will definitely be one of my albums of the year when I do my roundup towards the end of the year. It's absolutely brilliant.
Well, cheers, thanks. The check's in the post. Oh, sorry. I didn't mean that to go out in public.
No, it's excellent. And as you just said, everybody, the vinyl one is very, very limited. So if you want one of those, I'll put the links to your website and sure. Talking Elephant in the description and on the website. And that's where people can find out about the tour as well for any dates for 2024.
Yeah, they will be on there, yeah.
Fantastic. Well, take care, Dale, and thank you so much for your time this afternoon. It's been great to talk to you again. And best of luck with the album, and hopefully we'll talk again in the future.
I'm sure we will, Phil. You take care. Thanks. Thanks once again. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. So a huge thank you to my guest, Dale Bromham from the band Stray. That was absolutely fantastic chat, as usual. Such a great guy, so many stories. And this album, About Time, is absolutely superb, and I really recommend you go out and get a copy. You'll absolutely love it. So thank you for being here. Thank you for tuning in and subscribing to the Now Spinning Magazine podcast, to the YouTube channel, visiting the website, and of course, the private Facebook community as well. Remember, music is the healer and the doctor. Take care, keep spinning those discs, and I shall see you very, very soon.